Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Doing that, I was face to face with it. It was holding me by my throat, and it felt like it was sucking something out of me.
I probably should have been more scared than I was when I witnessed the exorcism.
I turned and looked on my right side. When I did, there's a beam on the side of the tree, a large beam. It's looking at me, and I'm looking at it.
After I hit the lock button and looked back up, I saw red eyes staring back at me.
That they're going to show multiple gods all over the earth, be able to speak in people's languages, and at that point, it kind of converge into this one entity, which will be revealed as extraterrestrial. You'll realize that aliens are the gods of old, and at that point, it'll wipe religion out of the context of humanity.
No way, it couldn't have been a person, I know that. I know that people can't run through the woods like that.
So this thing comes into view, and I see it. It's 50 yards away from me. It's walking. It's walking on two legs. It's huge. This is a big, hairy-looking being.
Welcome. I'm your host. This is uncomfortable.
Welcome back, my friends. I am your host, Eric Szilagyi. If you've had an uncomfortable experience and you'd like to have it featured on the show, please get a hold of me at contact.uncomfortable@gmail.com. The world wants to hear your experiences, so please get a hold of me and let's get yours on a future episode of Uncomfortable. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram, both at Uncomfortable Podcast 65, and please remember to leave us a 5-star rating and review where you can. That's the main way that you, the listener, can help get this show out in front of more people. And with more people listening, that means more people coming forward with their experiences. Head over to Uncomfortable Podcast on YouTube and check out the show in its video form. And while you're there, please hit subscribe and notification bell. That way you will be made aware every time I upload a video version of the podcast, which this episode is no different. I will be doing that as well. If you're interested in helping support the show, head over to patreon.com/uncomfortablepodcast770 and check out the three levels we have there. Or if a standalone contribution is more to your liking, you can do that as well through Red Circle, the sponsors this podcast link. Those and the Discord server will be in the show notes below. Bigfoot and Brews and Spirits 2 will be September 14th with the VIP dinner the night before. Both will be held at Sister Lakes Brewing Company in Dowagiac, Michigan. Confirmed are speakers Amy Boo from the Olympic Project and Project Zoo Book, Scott Tompkins from the Bigfoot Mapping Project, Salt Fork State Parks naturalist John Hickenbottom, and special guest author and journalist Chetan Noir. The paranormal part of the show will be headed up by the Archbishop Christina Rake to round out the day. Tickets will be on sale soon, no later than the second week of March. I will put out a special announcement as soon as those are available. Tonight, we're going to step back into the Wayback Machine and dive into some of the more significant historical UFO flaps that permeated the U.S. with my guest, author, and researcher, William Van Hus. William puts on the Wytheville UFO Fest happening June 8th in Wytheville, Virginia, and it is in the third year of its operation. If you're ready, let's get into it. please give a warm, uncomfortable welcome to William Van Hus. William, welcome to Uncomfortable.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us, man. I appreciate you. Interesting stuff. We're talking about my gateway drug into this paranormal realm. This is the UFOs were the first thing that I was completely obsessed with. You can look back and kind of guesstimate when you first started thinking about these things or really getting into it. I'm lucky enough to have a very hard, fast thing that I can look back at, and that is Chariots of the Gods, the documentary based on Eric Van Doniken's book. Came out in 1975, and I bugged the shit out of my parents, and my grandmother finally took me on a day that she was babysitting me, and my world was pretty much forever changed. With seeing that. So it was quite impactful. In fact, I've talked about this before. I looked over at the seat where my grandma was, and she was in the theater snoring, snoozing, drooling. And, you know, at five and a half years old, I can remember looking at her thinking, how can you be sleeping through this? This is amazing. And, I've been hooked ever since.
I was about the same age, and for me, it was, it was this book called, it's called Strange Stories, Amazing Facts, and it was a Reader's Digest book.
Yep, I remember it.
And it had all these different things in it. It's probably about 1980 or something. And it had all these different, everything from Jack the Ripper and Spring Hill Jack to like the Marie Celeste and, missing. Ghost ships and things like that. Yeah. And then UFOs, UFOs were the most, to me, was like, I was the most fascinated by that. And of course, all the ancient aliens, Von Daniken type of stuff was still very much alive. The 70s were still pretty alive in 1980.
Yeah, they were. So I mean,
good dose of that, In Search Of and
In Search Of was a big one. That mm-hmm. that was something that, man, I looked forward to that show every week. And it was with bated breath and anticipation to finally hear what was going to be on that episode. And, if it didn't have something to do with the weird stuff that I was into, I'd be like, I waited a whole week and it's,
yeah,
but
I know the feeling.
So, Wytheville UFO Fest, you're going into your third year. Tell us a bit about that.
We started it on the 35th anniversary of the Wytheville UFO wave, which was a pretty big wave of UFO sightings started in 1987. But it went for several years. And we live pretty close to there, but we're about 45 minutes away or something. But all that was still because it was happening in the region. It was all happening around here too. So I had my only UFO sighting was right after that,
So you literally had a sighting of your own.
Yeah. And this was in 91. So it was like a couple of years after the Wytheville UFO sighting. Usually they say it's like a couple of years, like 87, 88, 89, something like that. Mm-hmm. But it was still going on by the early 90s. In fact, after I wrote the book, I wrote Saucers Over Appalachia. After I wrote that, I got people contacting me from around here telling me about their sightings that they'd had around that same time that I did. But what happened was I was coming back from the grocery store with my, and I was picked up groceries for my mom, and we lived out in the country and we didn't have any lights around or anything. So I had a great view of the sky. And, like I said, I'd been interested in UFOs my whole life, but I'd never seen one or never even, I thought it was something that was like so rare that I would never see it,
Yeah.
But I was getting out of the car. I was bringing the groceries in, and I just happened to look up at the sky. And when I looked up, I noticed, like there was this, field of stars. And then amongst those stars, there were a bunch of stars that were brighter than all the rest of the stars, and they were all moving. And I was like, what is going on here? And it really like gave the impression of what it looked like was the way things move underwater. You know, so it was like there was about 12 of them, and they were all moving around. Like they would move, like some of them would move like this way, some of them would move this way. It was real kind of random.
Okay, yeah. Chaotic.
And they were like kind of floating that way. And I told my mom, and she didn't want to come outside.
Oh,
and
then really?
I went back outside and sat down. We had a little bench out there on the porch, and I sat down on the bench and just started watching them. And then one of them like stopped moving. And then another one went and made a whole circle around it. And then they shot a beam of light back and forth between the two of them.
Okay.
And then it kept going on. I mean, I can still see it like in my mind as if it just happened. You know, that's one of those things that made such an impression on me.
How old were you? How old were you at the time?
I was about 18, 17, 18.
So you were past the point of being a child with, you know, crazy imagination or.
Yeah, that was the year I graduated from high school. So I remember it very well. And I watched it for. They were still going. I watched it for probably about a half an hour, and then I went inside and they were still going when I went inside. But they were, I've only seen a couple of other descriptions that really, really matched what I saw, but I have seen a couple that where people have said that they'd seen something like that.
You know, it's interesting to me that, you know, so many times, and I think this is part of the problem with social media and TikTok and Instagram, and everybody that has, you know, one of these in their hands and they're taking videos or faking videos, you know, there's these 30 to 40 second clips that they hit us. And it's like, what happened to the, you know, 10 minutes before? What happened to the 10 minutes after this clip, you know? And it gives me pause because, you know, if I can't see things that are leading up to, I mean, I get being shocked by something and pulling your camera out and start filming. I get that. Mm-hmm. But there is a, you know, just to edit everything else out of it, I think becomes disingenuous on the part of the person who uploads it, because now you've eliminated, my ability, and I'm sure other people's ability, to kind of suss out the situation, the reaction, and all these things. So, you know, with the more and more with the advent of AI and being able to create all these crazy pictures and videos with AI, man, unfortunately, you know, I got to start throwing a lot of things out with the bathwater, you know, because just don't know.
Yeah. Somebody, you're trying to like doctor the evidence, you know, when you're like, you're selectively leaving certain things in and certain things out, you right. know. Unfortunately, I'm by the way, I apologize for my erratic camera movements right now. You'd think I was filming a UFO at this point, but I'm just on my phone. But yeah, it would have been nice to have had a camera at that time, but honestly, I don't think it would have shown up very well. I mean, you would have seen it. You would have seen lights moving around. But that's the thing with UFOs, and like a lot of times people think that, you know, that they're going to get these. Because everybody has these cameras with 4K, you know, or these phones with 4K cameras and things. And why don't we have all this amazing footage of UFOs, but go out right now and try to film the moon, you know, and see what that looks like. Yeah. It's not very amazing.
Well, it's interesting that your experience was as prolonged as it was, and mm-hmm. that you saw multiple craft and they were moving around each other. It's very, very similar to a gentleman that I follow out of Canada. His name's Justin Trapinski, and he's got a Bigfoot channel that's called Mountain Beast Mysteries. And he's been doing it for years, and he does a really good job. He's never fabricating anything. He's rarely ever really finds anything. Just has some odd occurrences that happen while he's out and filming. The guy's got King Kong size yabos, because I mean, he goes out by himself, and you know, he doesn't have a crew with him. He films his own stuff, but I think he moved fairly recently into a bigger city in Canada, and he's been getting this this video on multiple nights of these lights, very much like what you're talking about, several of them moving in unison, moving around each other. And, you know, the skies over Canada seem to be alive with these things. And I haven't seen any of them that actually look like they're shooting a light between the two of them. But the movement that you were describing, very, very similar to the videos that he's getting.
Yeah, it's unusual. The first thing I ever saw that that kind of sort of put me in the mind of that and reminded me of that sighting that I had was I remember probably 2005 or something like that when I first saw the NASA videos. You know, of when you have you seen those from like the space station with the disc shaped things that kind of looked like they had a hole in the middle of
when
them
when the tether was had broke loose,
all that. And that's the first thing that I was like, that I thought, oh, wow, that's the closest I've seen because they look like underwater, you know, creatures swimming or something, you know, like moving through the water. And that's kind of what this looked like, you know, it was extremely, just very unusual. Like if I had it my way, I would have seen a, you know, silver saucer, you know.
Classic, classic saucer.
Yeah. Yeah, but if I could have chosen what I would have seen, you know, then that would have been something like that. But you get what you get, you know.
Yeah, the closest that I can ever say that I came to, I've seen a couple of things in the sky. One fairly recently, like within the last 8 months, broad daylight, sitting in my living room, looking out through my picture window, and I saw what looked to be about maybe 2.5 times the size of a crow. Okay. It was long, again, but you know, about 2.5 times the size of a crow. It was in the center of it. It was very low profile and it was very long and narrow, but about center mass on this thing, there was I guess if I was going to have to describe it, I would say that it would have probably been like a clear globe and had like mirrors or something inside of it that were turning, that were reflecting all colors, all different colors of light, like blues and reds. And it was very flashy and very, very strange. And it was moving faster than a bird, but it wasn't like a blur. You know, I stood up, grabbed my phone, but by the time I had gotten my phone up to the point where I was going to, you know, try to access the camera, it had gone beyond the tops of the trees. I couldn't see it anymore. And it was very strange. You know, it was at about the height, I would say, from my perception of it, it would have been, like I said, about 2.5 times the size of a crow. And it would have been flying at about the same altitude as what I'm used to seeing birds flying. Cause we have a lot of oak trees on the other side of the street and they would roost in those oak trees all the time. So we've had crows forever and there's a lot of them. So I'm used to seeing them on a regular basis. And this was, you know, not a whole lot bigger. It was definitely a narrower body. I didn't see anything that would have indicated that there were wings, you know. It was very strange. And the other thing that I had happen was when I was about 13, Friday or Saturday night, don't remember what it was. I think probably was a Friday night, because that's usually the night my parents went out. My grandma lived with us, so she was at home. And it was about 10:30, quarter to 11 at night. I was watching Creature Feature on the Son of Svengoolie out of Chicago. And, you know, it was summertime. The windows were open. The door, the screen door was open. And all of a sudden, man, our dark neighborhood, just lit up super, super bright. And it was like so bright that nothing left shadows. And I can remember standing up. I was laying on the floor. I was on the prone, in a prone position on the floor with my hands under my chin, watching the show. And, I had heard an airplane, because we live really close to South Bend Airport, regional airport, and it's international now. But you know, we would have planes cross over where I lived, and I heard a plane coming. And when it got over the house, it just, I can remember looking back at my grandma and saying, man, it seems like that plane's been going overhead for a long, long time. You know, it just, mm-hmm. you know, there was no Doppler effect. You didn't hear it real quietly and then get loud and then get quiet again. It just stayed. And I don't remember if that sound was still going on when the light came on or not. But I remember standing up and looking out the window and looking across the street, and I could see inside the canopy of the trees. Even the backs of the leaves were lit up. Nothing was casting a shadow. I was seeing things in such detail. It was almost like, you know, going from the first color TV that we ever had to what you have now with an 8K TV that is just like, yeah. You feel like you could put your hand into it. I mean, it was that much more vibrant. And, you know, if I were to take a stab at how long the event lasted, I think it lasted, in my head, it's longer than what it really was, because just the amount of detail that I remember from looking out and seeing everything lit up that way. And then all of a sudden it just like somebody knocked a light switch off. And, I looked, as my grandma was pulling me away from the window, she said, get away from the window. It's probably a storm or something. And it was like, there was no storm. It wasn't raining. It wasn't lightning. There was no thunder. This was like a constant light that was on. And I can remember looking past it and seeing darkness beyond my neighborhood, which was weird.
Oh, wow. That's, you amazing.
Know, that was,
what do you suspect that was behind that?
You know, I never saw any source of the light. I was in awe, you know, because I simply didn't understand what was happening. And, yeah. When she grabbed me to pull me away from the window, she pulled me by my right arm. So I turned and down that, down the corner of my street, it curves, and there is a dusk to dawn light that is on the telephone pole. And it was just starting to warm back up. So whatever it was, I had that little bit of proof that, you know, something was bright enough that it shut the light off, and then it was such an immediate back to darkness that it was starting to glow again to come back on. 2 days later, my parents only got the newspaper on Sundays because they were cheap, and that was when the grocery ads would be in the newspaper. And I can remember that afternoon, my dad saying, "Hey, here's your freaking UFO story, kid." And he read, it was like maybe 5 lines in this tiny little article in the South Bend Tribune. And it said, "Residents of Hollyhock Road, just south of the state line, reported seeing lights, unusual lights over Claffey's Field." And Claffey's Field and Claffey's Pond is directly outside my neighborhood. And the street that they named Hollyhock is the road that is right on the outside of my, if you drive out of my neighborhood, you turn onto Hollyhock Road. So,
but they didn't give any possible explanations or anything. They just said
they just said several residents of Hollyhock Road, just south of the state line, which is exactly where I was. You know, so I mean, there was a little bit of indication, but you know, other than that, I got nothing. So I don't know what the hell it was, but whatever it was,
that's pretty unusual. I don't know if I've heard of those, of anything quite like that.
It was amazing. It was, and like I said, I could see beyond what was lit up. I could see dark skies behind it. And
yeah, that's what's cool.
And that was unusual.
You could see what was happening beyond it, you know, which everything normally dark.
That was really unusual. So
yeah,
that's creepy. That's pretty much the extent of what I think was probably a side effect of a UFO being around.
It could be.
But who knows?
It could be. It manifests in so many different ways. You know, I think it's like, and the thing that you said when you, about the bird, like, you know, sized object going by, you know, that's, there's so many different things that I've heard that are, you know, I think I agree with Jacques Vallée, you know, and kind of have for a long time that either there are like an almost unlimited number of extraterrestrial races and extraterrestrial craft that are just constantly visiting from so many different places, or whatever the intelligence is, has some sort of effect on our consciousness, and then that's interpreted in different ways by, like you see what you're able to see, basically.
Yeah, that's an interesting viewpoint, and I don't disagree with it. And you know, the longer that I've been steeped in this, and the more that I delve into any and all of the weirdness, whether it be UFOs, Bigfoot, paranormal experiences, hauntings, you know, cover all of it here. I'm quickly becoming a little more rooted in the idea that what some of these government whistleblowers like David Grush are saying, that the ultra-terrestrial or ultra-dimensional, because I was always firmly under the idea that, or the belief that these things were coming from another place, you know, another planet, another galaxy, another solar system, whatever. And now I mean, my gut is telling me that because of the differences and the weirdness of how these things operate, how they kind of, I mean, cause there's some videos, you know, that are a little bit longer in length, and it almost looks like they're phasing in and out, on their pathway as they travel. And it's like, you know, I mean, obviously we don't understand any of that technology. I imagine someplace here in the world does have a better understanding of that technology than we do. But, you know, I'm really kind of starting to think that these are, maybe these things are just, they're here with us, but
I think that's the case. I think the first, I guess, you know, I've read various theories over the years, but the, I think probably like, John Keel, and it, like, him and Jacques Vallée both kind of came up with this ultra-terrestrial thing around the same time, you know, early 70s, you know, to account for the wide variety, you know. And then Jacques Vallée kind of, like, is, you know, he said, you know, it also can account for the past, you know, when we go back into like angels and we, you know, and all these different things or whatever, you know, interpretations from the past of the same, you know, he would say that helps account for the past as well, you know, like where we had the different interpretations over the years. And then, and our interpretation of these things being spaceships from another planet obviously comes at the time when we're making spaceships and things, you know, and rocket science and all this is happening. And
right. And you know, Hollywood sci-fi was a huge proponent of that. You know, I mean, anytime you saw anything from outer space, I mean, they were from outer space. They were coming from other planets.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I mean, that's imagination and Hollywood magic. But, you know, the longer I'm into it, I'm really starting to think that those things are right here with us, whether they're on a different plane, whether it's our visual, our ability, the frequency that our eyesight is able to see, you know,
that's what I think. It's like, you know, things like, was it the, do you remember, do you ever read H.P. Lovecraft at any point in your life?
Yeah.
Where, when I was young, I was a teenager, I used to read Lovecraft and stuff a lot. And I remember he had a story, I think it was From Beyond. And it was like this scientist had come up with this device. And with this device, you were able to see what was really going on around you, you know? Mm-hmm.
And like so Dysonian goggles.
Yeah, all this all this other crazy activity, and it was like this insane, like, you know, these beings that, you know, intelligent beings that were like disembodied, that were just floating around, and, you know, all this kind of crazy stuff that was going on. I'm beginning to think that maybe it's more something like that, or I mean, there's also the theories about, like, that they live inside the earth, or the theories that they live under the ocean, or the, I also like the time travel, theories. 'Cause there's a lot of interesting evidence for that. You know,
you think there's a possibility that they're us from the future?
Yeah. Either us or some other occupants of this planet in the future, you know, because there's no guarantee that we'll be here, you know, in 50,000 years or, you know,
that's
whatever.
True. Yeah, that's
you know, true. You know, when you look at the past, you look at the history of the planet and you go, oh, well, let's go back 10 million years. You know, there's no people, you know, there's right. no, you know, and you go back another, you know, 50 million years, you know, and it's all dinosaurs. And, you know, you go back more and there's different things keep happening. So it's entirely possible that there would be something just completely different than us, you know, that would emerge, you know, in another, you know, million years or something like that.
Yeah. Also, I mean, I'm really starting to buy into the whole, you know, like whether you want to call it different dimensions or, gateways between time that we're seeing into that, those things, you know, whether it's Bigfoot or UFOs or, you know, the Loch Ness Monster. I mean, I talked to a gentleman who, and I actually talked to two guys independently who were in the same car and witnessed the same event, in New Mexico, probably about a year ago, that, the three gentlemen that were in the car, they witnessed what they could only describe as about a 3.5 foot long pterosaur.
No, wow.
Fly across the highway that they were on and cross over the hood of the car and off to the driver's side of the vehicle.
That's awesome.
Leathery wings, a spade tail, a long extended beak, a point at the back of the head. They said it literally just dropped their jaws to the floor because it looked like something out of Jurassic Park. And, you know, does it make sense that, you know, I mean, that's a remote location. So, you know, did something survive? Are they in a small number still alive somewhere? That's possible, but, you know, are we coming across these like tears in our reality?
I think we probably come across those more than we think. Have you ever had the experience where you, in all seriousness, the experience where you laid your keys on the sofa or on the table? You know where you laid your keys. You saw yourself lay them there. You walked away. You came back looking for them. They're not there, right? You look right where you laid them at, like here on the sofa. Well, I know I put them right here. Then you spend another hour looking around the house for them.
Mm-hmm.
Then you come back and they're right there on the sofa.
Yeah.
You know, you ever see had that happen?
In my episode that I just aired today, I actually talk about a situation that I purchased a piece of jewelry for my girlfriend, and it was a custom thing. It was something that I put a lot of thought into, and the woman that created it sent me a picture of it, and it was beautiful. I loved it. She sent it to me, and I opened it up, and it was everything was the same, but there was a different aspect to it, and it did not look like the pictures that she had sent me originally. And I was a little disappointed because I had my heart set on what she had sent me the picture of. Mm-hmm. It was still the same shape. It still had all the same components that I asked for. It was just, it was different. and it bugged me. It bugged me a lot. And I was going to give this to my girlfriend for Christmas. And I finally, you know, I had to justify it. It's like my girlfriend didn't know anything about what it looked like. She wasn't going to know any different. It was still a beautiful piece of jewelry. Mm-hmm. So I was like, screw it. I'm going to wrap it and I'm going to give it to her. She doesn't need to know anything about it. And I got tired of kind of obsessing over the fact that it wasn't what I expected from the previous picture. And I had even sent a message to the girl that designed it and made it. And I said, you know, I didn't want to bitch about it, but I had to say something, you know. It was just kind of eating at me. And I said, I didn't realize that you were going to fill all that area in. You had negative space in there before. I thought it was going to be like that. And she responded to me by saying, I hate empty spaces. I'm kind of OCD about that. So, you know, and it was fine. It was a beautiful piece. And so I gave it to her, and she opened it up and it was exactly like what the picture was. And I was like, what the hell is going on here? Because I had looked at that thing for, you know, the better part of 2 weeks before I wrapped it. And I wrapped it just to get it out of my head, just to be like, I can't obsess about this anymore. And when she opened it and it looked the way it was supposed to look, I was like,
yeah, see what I mean? Pterosaur.
No idea.
Yeah. Pterosaur. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the thing, reality, I don't think reality is as fixed as we would like it to be. You know?
I'm starting to believe that. I really am. You know, the Mandela effects, some of them I think are horseshit. Other ones, I'm like,
most of that's just people not remembering things right.
Right. But there's a few that really kind of perk my ears up, and because I remember specifically, you know, I'm a huge Star Wars fan. Like to the point where I would not make a mistake that Darth Vader said, Luke, I'm your father versus no, I'm your father. You know, I've watched that movie so many times and went to see it so many times at the theater. That to me, that's one that sticks with me. It's like somebody's messing here. I don't know that I believe that those are shifts in our reality as much as, you know, maybe for whatever reason, some kind of a psyop to see what they can get over on us.
Do you remember the story? You've probably heard this one before about the guy. And there are several stories that are similar, but the one I'm thinking about is the guy who was a pilot, and it was back, I believe it was in England. And this was in like, I want to say it was like the 1970s, late 60s, early 70s or something. And this guy was flying and over an airfield in Scotland. And once he got to the airfield, like there had been some bad weather and his instruments were doing crazy things. And he was flying on just on instruments there for a while. You know, it's Scottish gray skies, you know. And then once he emerges, he knew he was supposed to be near this airfield. And when he emerged near the airfield and he looked down to see it, he could see the airfield, but it was all World War II fighter planes on the airfield.
I do remember that. Like they actually, they actually made a Twilight Zone. It was, I think it was Twilight Zone. Either Twilight Zone or Night Gallery did an episode that was based on that story.
Yeah, so something like that, you know, and it's just like, and, you know, he didn't land so he could go out and say, hey, are you guys from 1945 or anything? You know, it's like he just kept going, and then he ended up like going back to his place, you know, and then he ended up going and researching, looking up photos of that airfield during the war. And sure enough, during the war, like they had fighter planes there, and then they had the people were wearing, because he said he saw the guys wearing these blue jumpsuits out there. Mm-hmm. On the you know, fueling planes and stuff, and he saw he found out through like researching it that's what they wore there and stuff, you know, that the things were accurate. Yeah. You know, so
yeah, how strange, you know, would that be?
Weird, yeah, one of those weird, and then you miss the opportunity of stopping, you know. Yeah. that's what's wild. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know that I would have landed that would have, if I had seen that seems like that would have been a little too weird. I think
I would have probably landed. Okay. Being 50 years old, I probably would have landed. Now, if I was draft age, I might not have landed.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Let's get into the flap. Let's get into the flap from 73.
Let's go.
What do you think the catalyst was? What was, I mean, because we're talking, you know, near 100 different events, really, and hundreds of people reporting these events.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is like a timeline as far as when did this start? I know that it didn't necessarily end in 73, it continued on and, so tell me what you know about it.
Well, it's tough to say, when one flap ends and another begins, really, because, you know, there was this theory that's resurfaced a few times over the years about like a 61 month cycle, I think it is, something like that, or 5 year cycle of, for UFO flaps. But really, in the research that I've done over the years, I don't find that this holds too much weight, because if you look at, that's only if you're restricting your scope to like one country, like America or something. But if you're looking at it worldwide, there seems to be no end, you know.
Yeah.
And there's never really an end. Of course, there's like maybe there's more sightings this, you know, month or whatever than there was the last month. But in the case of the 1973 one, as far as America is concerned, but there were a lot of sightings that year also in South America and of course other places in the world. But as far as North America, United States is concerned, it seemed like earlier in the year, it almost mirrored the 1896, 87, 97 airship wave, you know. And a little bit, because it kind of started out west earlier in the year. You get more reports out west. Then for some reason, you start getting around April or so, you start getting more reports in the Midwest. And it isn't until the fall, really late summer, early fall, that you start getting the reports in the South. And those are the ones that are most remembered from that year, because that's when Pascagoula abduction, you know, happened. And in October, September, October is really when it kind of started ramping up. And then of course it kept going, but I think the peak of it though, it really overall probably was late summer and fall, even though they were, tons of reports all over the country really before that.
Do we have a guesstimate or an estimate of how many significant events there were during that time?
Oh man. I mean, you can go to like I think NICAP, the archived website for NICAP, has a whole bunch of them. What they considered significant, but you know, if you look at that, you're probably going to find, you know, in a neighborhood of like 50, 60, 70, something like that. Mm-hmm. But then there's almost none of them are any of the ones that I found, you know, so, you know, it'd be hard to say. I would imagine that would be, you know, in the hundreds, maybe 1,000, you know, that would be like significant enough to have made the newspapers, because if you were to go, you know, no one had ever done this research on this region that I live in, you know, and that's when I did the book Saucers Over Appalachia, that's what I was doing, was I was doing the region. I was doing this region because I knew that the 1973 wave as a whole is like such a broad scope. It'd be hard to do unless, I mean, you could maybe do a 1,000-page book or something like that, you know, like describe them all. But But what I wanted to do is to do this region. And what I encouraged other people to do in the book was, like, go to your library, wherever you live, and look up, go to the microfiche and look up all the newspapers around you and see when it happened where you are. Because I bet you it happened. Mm-hmm. You know, I bet you there was a bunch of the front pages of all the newspapers in your region were covered up in UFO stories for at least a week, you know, just about, no matter where you are, you know.
Yeah.
And in our area, and this is like East Tennessee, Southwest Virginia, you know, this really five state type of region. Like, you have West Virginia right there that touches Virginia, and then you have a little bit of Kentucky, a little bit of North Carolina there.
And even Ohio, too.
Yeah, there was a bunch in Ohio. Yeah.
What is it about that region? What is it about that? Because it's not just UFO stuff. Ohio is thick with Bigfoot reports. Tennessee is thick with Bigfoot reports. You know, you have so much high strangeness that takes place in the Appalachians. And, you know, you've got everything from people that are still worshiping the little g gods, you know, Lilith and those things. And there's just so much strangeness, you know. And the show Hellier, I'm not sure if you've seen that or not, miniseries, I think it was on Prime, you know. Whether that was all true or whether that was written, either way, it was a very interesting show. If it was made up, kudos to them for making it up, because that sucked me in and enthralled me for the entire length of the show. But it kind of highlighted the weirdness of that region and that area, you know. And what is it about that? Those states, I mean, are there ley lines there, or are there, you know, is there some kind of triangle that we don't know about?
We've always suspected it. Like, most of the people that I know have always said it, like, talked about things like that. Of course, we've always lived here, so I don't know what it would be like to not live in an area like this that much. But, you know, there's things like the Brown Mountain Lights, you know. Have you ever heard of that?
I have, yeah. And they actually have something very similar to that up in northern Michigan, above on the upper peninsula above Wisconsin. It's called the Paulding Light, and I've actually been there three times, witnessed it. It's a bizarre thing.
Yeah, Brown Mountain Lights is about an hour away from us, and then there's another place that's very near us. It's just an odd anomaly that, and it's off of an exit. So if you're going down this highway, there's an exit off the highway, and the exit kind of goes downhill. You know, it goes at a little, not a steep grade, but, you know, a gradual downhill like that. You know, and then there's a stop sign at the bottom of that exit. And then you can go to the bottom of that exit in your car and stop your car and put your car in neutral, and your car will go back up the exit, you know? Yeah. One of those weird gravitational anomalies or something. There's a lot of real strange things. And I've known people that have seen, like, the little, like elf type beings or whatever in the woods, goblins. You know? Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. Like a little weird, like, kind of, forest elemental or something, yeah. You know, I've known people have seen things like that. I've known people that have said they've seen, you know, big Black Panther, you know, odd thing to see. Of course, UFO sightings and things like that, you know, but I don't know, magical place, really. There's certain places on Earth, you know, like, you know, and these mountains are so old, you know, it's the oldest mountain range in the world, you know, and Mount Shasta out in California is another one, you know, that has all this strange stuff attached to it, you know. It's just certain places. I don't know if it's ley lines or what it is. And, but it, yeah, it definitely attracts, high strangeness. That's for sure.
So this flap was not just like just conventional looking 1950s sci-fi saucers. We had, reports of cigar shaped. We had reports of triangular shapes. You know, and triangular shapes have not been that popular until fairly recently, you know, say the last 10, 15 years. Now we're hearing a lot about the triangular shapes. But you know, even back then in 73, you know, there were triangular shapes, cigar shapes. There were the classic saucer shapes. There were, illuminated blue mists that were showing up. People were seeing lights in the woods or just above the tree lines.
Well, in the Withville UFO wave in, you know, it's beginning in 87, there were triangular craft in that. And then that's also the Belgian UFO wave in like 89, around that same time, where there was a triangular craft, were really a major part of that. And then, of course, if you think of the Phoenix Lights, you know, which could have been like one enormous triangular craft, if we know, you know, we have no idea, I guess, because nobody really got to see it, but it illuminated in that way, you know, but that could be, or the, what's the one in Rendlesham Forest?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was like 81 or something like that. That was kind of a triangular type of thing. And then a lot of times that gets related when people talk about the triangular ones, they get really lumped into like, oh, well, this one's secret, you know, government stuff, right. You know,
which I, but, you know, I mean, I'm okay with that. I think there is probably some component of these sightings that is extraordinary craft that we have within our military. And I am firmly of the belief that we, as far as our security and our military is concerned, as far as protecting us and, you know, keeping us safe as a nation, we don't need to know everything. You know, I'm okay with there being secrets. But I don't think all of this is military.
No, I mean, well, you know, you're talking about the diversity of the sightings and the craft and things in the 1973 one. And, it's funny, you know, back then you had a lot of craft like, you know, in the 60s and the 50s, and then still in the 1973 wave, you had a lot of craft that were like egg shaped, and you had a lot of craft that had like, that would have landings where they would have these little legs, you know, like that type of stuff. So there were certainly a lot of that around this region. And there was not so much in the triangular, but a lot of egg shape, a lot of cigar shape, a lot of saucer shape.
What's the one I'm thinking of that looked a lot like an acorn?
Kecksburg.
Yeah. That, you know, were there any of those references to that kind of a shape?
No, but to that color, yeah, to a copper color. There was one in a, there's a little community called Watauga that's, and a lot of times people mispronounce it Watuga or something like that, but I believe it was a Cherokee word that meant water, but there's a lake there. It's called Watauga Lake, a little redundant, but there's a little community there. And one of the sightings there was, there was a woman who looked out her back door, and she had her kids were outside playing in the yard. And she looked, and this is like broad daylight, you know, middle of the day. She looked outside and saw a circular, like a spherical, a copper colored craft descend into the backyard, almost to where it was touching the ground, but didn't land on the ground. And then a doorway open in the craft and a being reach out to grab the kids. The kids take off running into the house, and then the craft zips off straight up into the air. Now you would think that, oh, well, this is clearly made up, you know, but several other people independently called the police that same day and reporting that a craft, copper colored spherical craft floating around the neighborhood. It's a very strange one.
That would creep me out.
Yeah, that's a weird one. You know, like to be corroborated by other people, you know, who didn't know this woman, you know, who had also seen it, you know. And but so you had like they called 1973 wave the year of the humanoids is what they call it, because there were so many abductions and there were so many close encounters where people actually came in contact with the beings from the craft.
That's interesting to me. Let's touch on some of those.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was one that I just described that happened in our region. And then of course there was the Pascagoula one, you know, that's probably the most famous. There was actually one that happened right after the Pascagoula one, it wasn't in Mississippi, but it was in like Alabama, I believe, where police saw beings that they described as being like the Pascagoula ones, because that's one of those that you never hear any other description.
That was a very unique description of an entity.
With the lobster claws and the wrinkly skin and stuff. Like somebody else did describe that. I can't remember off the top of my head what the name of the town was or the people that saw it, but there is another case out there with the description of those. And of course there was, you know, a multitude of other beings like at the same time. And a lot of them, usually they looked human.
Human, you know, in the sense of actually looking human or just being a humanoid shape?
No, I like looking human. And just like when you, if you go back into the, you know, when you go back into the 1950s and look at a lot of the cases back then, or even the 40s, even you go back to the 30s, there are cases back then, long before the, Kenneth Arnold and Roswell and all that. If you go back then, you find a lot of descriptions of human, they look just like humans, you know. And of course you have your Nordic, you know, they call the Nordic ones, you know, they always have the blonde hair and they're super hot and all that. but you also have ones that are just, that don't really fit that description, but they just look human, you know. And I think that might speak a little bit to the, what we're, that sometimes maybe we see what we can hope with seeing.
Yeah, exactly. That's the point I was going to get to as well. You know, like the Nordics are usually always described as having long hair, thin, slender bodies, very attractive, very, you know, beautiful people. if there's any truth to the, what's that?
They really know how to rock a blue jumpsuit too.
you know, if there's any truth to, excuse me, if there's any truth to the valiant Thor mythos, you know, not long hair, very, very stunning looking man. You know, I mean, there's photographs of him, you know, who knows if it was an actual thing or not. Mm-hmm. But
there were a lot, and you know, a lot of the contactees from that time, you know, and of course many of these people, you know, Howard Menger or George Van Tassel or George Damski, a lot of those people at that time, you know, the aliens that they were describing were humans.
Was there any indication of what was the message that they were getting?
Those contactees? Yeah. Well, that message was always, it was always pretty much the same. You know, it was about nuclear weapons. You know, it's about they're interfering before we blow ourselves up with nuclear weapons. And to, you know, it was always a message. That's why they always called them the Space Brothers and stuff. You know, it was either a positive message and a very sort of precursor to a hippie kind of message, really, you know. In fact, you know, George Van Tassel lived in California, and he had, that's his place called is out near Joshua Tree, called Giant Rock. And it was because there was a giant rock there, but it was an airstrip. And his wife and him ran they owned this airstrip. He had worked for, I think he'd worked for maybe Boeing or something like that. But then he bought this little airstrip out there, and he and his wife had ran this little cafe, and they had like the little airstrip where they refuel planes and stuff from private planes. Small planes flew there. And once he had his first contact experience, he started having these like conventions out there where he would have people come. And some of the other people came there, like George Adamski came there. And it sort of became like almost a little sort of a bit of a hippie new age kind of a commune situation, you know, predating a lot of that, you know. So before, you know, we always had these positive messages, either that or somebody like Howard Menger, who was like having sex with the aliens or whatever. But like you either had that kind of thing happening, you know, and they were saying they were from Venus, you know, or something like that. And then, but by the time you get to the 60s, then you get into the, it's only then when you get into the, Betty and Barney Hill type of, you know, abductions where it's, there's these terrifying implications, right, about it, you know, and there's sort of a nightmarish experience. It's no longer the Space Brothers telling you how to live in peace, you know, that they're taking you and doing experiments upon you, you know. Very interesting how that.
Yeah. Helped. And I don't know. I guess I have a thought on that. And that thought is that, at least what I hope it is. Okay. Obviously there's the possibility that there's multiple species, or if it's, if it's the same species, you have a good faction and a bad faction, just like you have good and bad people everywhere. But you know, the Space Brother thing seemed to be so prevalent for a good while. And then we start getting the scary stuff. Then we start getting the abductions, the medical, experiments or procedures being done. And, you know, that almost time-wise almost lines up for me with about the time that we would have had the Roswell crash in our possession long enough that we may have been able to back engineer some certain components of it. And then, as far as the military is concerned, using that against our own people to find out how possibly other nations would react if they were to do a fake invasion or use that kind of technology to go against another country in a wartime situation. You know, the cattle mutilations and all that stuff just seems to me to be too weird to be something that somebody who spent God knows how much time coming to Earth or traveling through dimensions to get to where we are to go do dastardly things to cattle. You know.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. I hadn't really heard that, but it makes sense, you know. But there's also like a lot of early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, you get a lot of sightings that appear to be clearly, you know, something man-made. Like, because these things aren't running right, you know. Like they're making, you know, you have the ones that are making a lot of noise when they're running.
And also seeing seams and seeing like literal nuts and bolts holding them together.
And seeing people, occupants of them that look like people, and that, like, for instance, like there was one I remember, I can't remember exactly when this happened, but I believe it was like late 1950s, early 60s, where this man came out and they asked him for water. Like the beings from the craft looked like people, and they just got out and said that they needed some water. And he brought them water. And then that's when they gave him those little biscuits.
Oh, I do remember that one. Yeah, I remember the biscuits.
They gave him these little weird little pancake biscuit things, you know, like this sounds like people, yeah. You know, it sounds like some sort of like, you know, you have some that like have pipes visible on them and stuff, you know, which doesn't really sound like the, you know, the type of UFOs that we're used to hearing about or that would really blow your mind. Because if I saw something with some exhaust pipes on it, I'm going to assume that's of human right. origin, you know.
What do you think the difference is? Why, you know, like, so you take Roswell, you know, the whole enduring story that Roswell, it's just never gone away. And you've got the Rendlesham Forest incident. You've got the Betty and Barney Hill thing. You've got so many accounts that have captured our imagination for so long. And they've just not ever gone away. But now that we have whistleblowers, government whistleblowers, we have military people who are coming forward talking about seeing these things. There seems to be a more matter of factness about how it's talked about. And, you know, it doesn't have the same feel to me. As these things, and you know, is that just maybe a component to the way times were at the point where these other things had happened, or is there been a major shift?
Well, I think there's been a major shift in the government position, and I think when you think about people like now, I'm not, you know. I mean, no disrespect to anybody's military service or David Grush and his, you know, I know he served in Afghanistan and all those things, but he is an intelligence officer, correct. You know, and you have, and the other people that are coming from, you know, that we've seen, you know, we've seen a lot of people like Luis Elizondo. We've seen people like Christopher mm-hmm. Mellon. We've seen people speaking out. A lot of the people speaking out about this are from the intelligence community. And I don't know if anybody remembers, but for 70 years or so, the intelligence community has called everybody yeah. crazy that said, you know, and all of a sudden now we're allowing these people to frame the story, you know, to frame the whole narrative. You know, we're allowing them, they changed UFO to UAP. Now they, you know, they want to frame it in such a way. It feels to me like they want to frame it in such a way that it's a national security oh, threat. And that we need more money for the intelligence community, and we need more money for the Pentagon in order to deal with this Chinese balloons and the Chinese and the Russian drones and things like that. They're trying to frame it in that respect. And I don't hear anybody saying, like, look, there was a flying cube, okay? A sphere with a cube in it, right? What's his name? The pilot saw off the coast of Virginia, yep. right? The yep. Graves, Ryan Graves. He describes this this cube, this sphere with a cube in it. Okay, there was one of those in the Withville wave in 1987. So, do you think they had did they have that kind of crazy drone technology in 1987? No, I don't think so. And did they have do they have spheres that can go like thousands of miles an hour into the ocean and back out to the atmosphere? Do they have that? You know, because they've had that since like, what is that, Cape Girardeau yeah. or whatever, you know, 1941. You know, did they have that type of technology? So they're ignoring everything that happened before the Nimitz, you know, basically. Like they're acting like UFOs began in 2004.
And that is a hard one to get past. I agree.
So that's the problem I have with all the whistleblowers and all the, you know, because they're framing it in such a way that there's no apology for all these people whose lives have been destroyed. You know, there's no apology to all the people who have had abduction experiences and been laughed at and ridiculed and stuff like that. There's no apology to all the people who have called the, you know, Air Force or whatever and the police and reported these things and then been made fun of, you know, and been a laughing stock. They're just acting like it just began. And this problem is not only did it just begin, it's the problem is really limited to these certain spaces over the ocean, over Catalina Island and off of Southern California or Chesapeake Bay. You know, this is all you're hearing about. You know, you're not hearing about the, you know, thousands and thousands of other like sightings and experiences that people have had for so long, you know. And so until there's some sort of acknowledgement of that, you know, I don't have any faith in the public face of UFO disclosure. Well, and
you would certainly think. Now, I get from the military aspect that, you know, we're not gonna give any other countries any information that might circumvent our national security. Right. But you know, the UK has been way more open about their UFO investigations through the government for a lot of years. It just seems to me that how strange that our military Graves would have taken part in this this disclosure, congressional disclosure that happened down in Mexico, where they unveiled the ridiculously bad mummies, mummified remains of it's just
those crazy little those little alien things.
I mean, that forget the name of the guy who has a show down there. He was like a big part of the disclosure there. Jaime somebody. You know, that guy has been outed as a hoaxer and you know, so many times over the years that it floored me to find out that they actually had him being a part of it. You know, everybody says, oh, these things were put through different types of x-rays and different types of scanning, you know, and it's so ridiculous. I mean, they're not letting anybody in the States do it. You know, and the people that have seen the MRIs of it, you know, they're actually calling out what the bones that were put into these plaster mummies are, you know, what they're from. You know, and Ryan Graves, he was sent down there to kind of represent America in this thing, and he flat out refused to have his pictures taken by the mummies or any of that stuff. He didn't want anything to do with it.
It's funny. Yeah. I feel like, you know, when I saw him respond to it, you know, and it felt like he may have been genuinely sort of duped into participating in that. And he was very embarrassed by that. But at the same time, my first reaction was when I saw him in that situation, before he had apologized and everything, my first reaction was what I thought of was people like Richard Doty. You know that guy?
Yeah.
The CIA guy who who infiltrated MUFON and spread disinformation and stuff all through the 80s, you know? Like, there's a lot of that, you know, that happens. Like, where these government so-called whistleblowers, a lot of times they're just out to be whistleblowers so they can get into this UFO community and then seed it with disinformation. You know, and that's what I kind of first thought when I saw Ryan Graves in that situation. It's like, oh, is he doing that? You know, but I don't think he was, you know, but it really, you know, made me think that. I mean, forgive me for being suspicious of these people, but
I think you have to be.
I think there's good reason to be very suspicious of anybody who carries any sort of security clearance when it comes to the United States intelligence community.
My biggest fear here is that for the majority of my life of believing in these things and never wavering, never falling away from it, never having a period of time where I was like, yeah, no, this ain't right. a few years ago, getting the first like limited disclosure that oh my God, the government is actually admitting these things are real. My biggest fear is that we are no closer to knowing what they are or where they come from. Yeah, and that all of this is just one big distraction to get us to look the other way. And to not see what, I don't know. But yeah. my fear is that we may not know anything more than we knew 40 years ago.
It probably is. I personally, it seems more like we're talking about ultra-terrestrials, other dimensional, maybe time travel, all these other sort of possibilities other than nuts and bolts, spaceships from another planet type of hypothesis. Now, I personally feel that that's probably, it's if we ever got to a true explanation of it, it's going to have something to do with, it's going to have some mind-blowing implications for what we think reality is, Whereas, so therefore, I've always been kind of suspicious of crash retrievals, But if you look into it, and that's where you put your effort is to research crash retrievals, you're going to find some real convincing evidence about crash retrievals, because it's out there, Now, so I would say that what can the government offer? What can the government offer in disclosure? What do they know that we don't know? There's a community of people, tens of thousands strong. I don't know how many people for so long, whether it's from MUFON, whether it's from, any manner of independent people, podcasters and people that, investigators run magazines and do, people that have personal experiences. We've got the data that we have as private citizens has to be far exceed the data that the government has, because what
you would think,
the only thing they could have that we don't have would be a crash retrieval. that's really the only thing they have to offer,
Yeah.
So if they have that, then I'd like to know about it, But if they don't have that, then that puts them in a position just like us. They don't know any more than we do, because I don't think that my intuition tells me that Eisenhower didn't meet with aliens. You know what I mean?
I got to agree with that.
I don't think they're that deep into it. I don't think that the aliens are negotiating with them and they have underground bases where they're working together and stuff like that,
Yeah. And that there was an agreement to allow humans to be abducted for their own nefarious purposes in return for technology.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard that. It makes a great story. If I'm wrong, then hey, I'm wrong, and I would love to know the truth. But I want to know the truth either way. But to me, my intuition tells me that they don't know where they come from or what they're doing here, and they have no control over it whatsoever, just as much as we don't know, And when they do tell you where they come from, like they told Betty and Barney Hill and showed them that star map, or told people they're from Venus or tell people, how much of that do you believe? How much do you believe them when they tell you that, do you think they're telling you the truth? Because they seem kind of trickstery, Yeah.
So, and then you get into, again, Luis Elizondo, part of the intelligence community. But if you listen to him, he's a masterful, he's masterful at dropping breadcrumbs that will
he's good at teasing a story that never comes.
You know? Yeah. And, you know, I've seen him on several interviews where he talks about the Pentagon official or general or whatever the hell it was that told him, "Hey Lou, let this stuff go, you know, back away from it and just stop." And he's like, "Okay, sir, but you know, can I ask you why?" And he says, "We already know what they are." And he alludes to that it is based in religion and that they're actually demons. And right. You know that what?
I watched so many interviews with Lou Elizondo when he first came out and started talking about all this. I watched every interview and I listened very carefully to everything he said, and I was suspicious of him and everything from the get go because of who he was. But I watched and I listened and I tried to be open minded, and what I saw was a guy who made a bunch of promises and none of them ever happened.
Yeah.
You know, he was a guy who was like, "Later this year, I'm coming out with some new evidence. It's going to rock the world." And then later that year, it didn't come. "Next year, I'm coming out with some new evidence. It's going to, you know," and it's kicking it down the line so much. Now he's got a book that's coming out, you know, he's pushing a book and stuff like that.
What's he going to put in the book? He going to put in it? Because every time you hear him, there's things he can't talk about.
Yeah, the book's going to be wait till part two of this book. You know? I'll really evidence, you know.
You know, and it's like, and here's the other thing. It's like, so you got Christopher Mellon, you got Luis Elizondo, you got, you know, these other people, and they all line up behind some dude who plays in Blink 182.
Yeah. Don't that seem a little suspicious? Well, like they're
you couldn't pick a better person.
Well, this guy was willing to put up some money, and he was also willing to be played by these people. You know, that's what it seems to me. You know, like it just looked like he surrounded himself with people who are just got some shady pasts. You know, Hal Putoff is in there.
Yeah.
You know, some people like I find these people interesting. You know, I'd love to interview them too, but that I don't believe them. You know, they're gonna have to, and especially Lou Elizondo. Like, this guy's not. What's he revealed? You know, what is his big reveal? I haven't seen anything. You know, yeah. I have no idea what he's supposed to be like saying, because every question he's asked, he just charges around it like he's like, you're not much of a whistleblower if you're not saying anything.
If you're not blowing the whistle.
Yeah. So if I mean, it's not a situation. This is not like, putting military lives at risk because you're going to give away some, plans of, or some where some base is or where some attack's going to happen or anything like that. This is UFOs. You know, what do you know? And once you tell us what you know, okay, you know, now we heard what you have to say. You know, but there's not been any. It's just people saying, "I know something and I'm going to tell you," you know, and if anybody, like if any one of us, like a regular everyday citizen were to have done that, we'd just be laughed out of the, out of the
and
room.
You know who else who does this? And I hate to say it because there have been some good things that have come out of this guy. Jeremy Corbell.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I mean, he does the same damn thing, you know, you know,
we got more footage, you know, all that stuff, and then releases that really goofy, like, what was that last thing with the spaghetti monster thing? Looked
like a jellyfish.
Yeah. That is obviously some sort of drone, you know? It's flying in a straight line over the, you know, it's like, and then, what was that, Chris, do you know that the girl, Chris, I think her name is Christina Gomez? And she has a podcast also, but she actually went and found like this drone thing, and there was some footage of it. It looked exactly like that thing.
Really?
It looked exactly like it. And it showed people holding it. You know, it was like some test footage of it, and there were people like holding it, and it would It was like flying out of their hand, you know, into the
air. I have not heard about that. No.
And there's real, it was on her thing on her YouTube channel. And she posted that and a bunch of people jumped down her throat and were like, you know, Jeremy Corbell fans, I guess, jumped down her throat and were like, no, that's not the same thing. And it's like, man, I don't know that it is, but I saw both footage and it really looks like the same thing. You know, it really does. So, you know, I think Jeremy Corbell is well-meaning and I think he really wants to be like, you know, I think he's really,
I agree. Yeah, I agree.
He's on. And I think he really wants to find the truth and put this stuff out there. And George Knapp also, you know, I think I got confidence in him, but I didn't have confidence in that video.
Yeah. It's a very strange one. I
think they put stock in some of these whistleblowers too, you know, to be honest, but
yeah. The one guy that I have really felt was credible is Commander Fravor.
Oh yeah, yeah.
He strikes me as being very credible. Even Ryan Graves struck me as being very credible. I really, there's a caveat there. I got to put a little asterisk by that because why he was sent to the thing down in Mexico is beyond me, and that puts a little mark on him for me that I'm like, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Well, thing is like, you know, Ryan Graves and those guys at Fravor, you know, even David Grush or whatever you say his name, he, like those guys, like, you know, I can like them and I can think they seem credible, you know, to me, but they're supposed to seem credible.
Absolutely.
You know, and I have to still look at them with the same suspicion that they would look at me, you know, like if I go to the report a UFO sighting and say that, you know, a UFO landed in my yard and aliens came out of the UFO and they took me on board the UFO and they did this and that to me and all that. And if I went to the government and reported that to them, they're going to look at me with a certain amount of suspicion, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think it's only understandable if I look at them with the same amount of suspicion.
What's your thoughts on Stephen Greer?
Man, it's tough. I'll tell you, Stephen Greer, I hate to be in all these weird positions, but like I'm having to just move around. It's hard, man, because I believe that he's credible on some of the things that he says, but I'm suspicious of anyone, you know, who charges a whole bunch of money and says they can put you in contact with aliens, you know?
Yeah.
Like his CE5 stuff or whatever that he's doing.
Yeah.
Like where you pay me $1,000 and I'll, you know, I'll teach you how to communicate with aliens. You know, that feels a lot, that feels a little televangelist to me, you know? And I've also seen him, you know, he doesn't really ever do, you know, I saw him. Do you ever watch a Kirk John Mungles podcast?
I don't.
He has a podcast. There's this guy, he's a mathematician and physicist, and he has a podcast and it's called Theories of Everything. And he has all kinds of great thinkers on there from different, you know, physicists and a lot of UFO stuff on there too. Well, he had Stephen Greer on there. After much, he tried to get him on forever, and it took a long time because Stephen Greer doesn't want to do anything but his thing. You know, he wants to keep his stuff restricted to his thing so he can monetize it in the way that he wants to monetize it. So he finally came on there, and it was like one of the most like rude and like know-it-all. Anytime anybody like, I don't know, I'm suspicious of anybody who acts like they know the answer and they know it all, because I don't really think anybody does, you know?
Yeah.
And when you see people, that's why I like Jacques Vallée, because Jacques Vallée has been at this longer than just about anybody. And, You know, he'll admit that he doesn't know something. You know, he'll say, I don't, you know, it looks like this. It looks like it could be this. It bears the resemblance of this, or it bears like possibility that it could be this, but I don't know. You know, I don't know for sure, yeah. You know, and I don't think anybody knows for sure. So when you have a lot of people like Stephen Gurr has a lot of very specific answers that he's never, the word I don't know doesn't seem, or the phrase I don't know doesn't seem to even be in his vocabulary. You know, it's like anytime he's asked a question, he has an answer for it, you know, and sometimes maybe that's not, I don't know, it just doesn't seem as credible to me.
Well, it strikes me, I interviewed Klaus Svahn from Sweden of probably pretty close to a year ago now. And the thing that struck me with the 40 years, roughly 40 years of his investigating and researching and collecting and data mining and all the stuff that he's done as far as the UFO topic goes, how skeptical that man is. It was amazing to me that somebody could be that steeped in the topic and have remained that skeptical about that many things. He had very few things throughout his collection of information, whether it's anecdotal or you know, evidence about sightings or witness accounts and stuff like that. There were very few things that he held with high regard as being actual and factual.
I think it helps to stay very skeptical, you know, even in the light of like having, you know, even if you've had an experience yourself, you know, to stay skeptical and but also stay open-minded at the same time. Like, I don't know, I try to like consider everything. And at the same time, so I go back and forth, you know, and it's all right. Like, I think it's all right to like one day feel this way and then another day feel that way, you know, because we're not like, this isn't, you know, we're not doing a deposition here. You know, we're not like, you know, this is not, you know, we're just trying to figure out and as best we can, what we can figure out as individuals and, you know, as collective, like just, you know, people who collect evidence, you know? And so I think it's a healthy attitude to stay skeptical and also listen to everyone. I don't dismiss things out of hand, you know, like, I'll listen to what like, these people have to say to the government, you know, for instance, like these whistleblowers and stuff, I'll listen to it. But there's only so long I'm going to listen to somebody saying, you know, tomorrow I'll tell you more, you know. But, you know, one thing I did on that topic, one thing that made me think we live in this is a great time to be alive, was when I saw him coming out. You know, they had the last hearing, they had the public hearing, and then they had the one where they did it with the intelligence. It was the private.
Yep.
You know, intelligence hearing or whatever. And then they were coming out of that hearing. And I remember, you know, the Congresswoman Luna in, on the panel. So she comes out there and there and somebody asked her, they said, did you learn anything more than you knew, you know, in there? And she's like, oh yeah. And they said, what do they think? You know, what's in charge, what's the cause of these UAPs? What's behind all this, you know? And she said on C-SPAN, and standing in the Capitol, like, you know, well, in a legitimate, she said, interdimensional beings. And I was like, oh, wow, I love being alive right now. That made me so happy to see that, because I was like, wow, that is the coolest thing I've ever seen. It's like a sitting congressperson, like talk about interdimensional beings on live on C-SPAN. Yeah. It was amazing. Yeah, it's worth looking up if you see, because they each come out and they all have, you know, Tim Burchett comes out and, you know, all the people that were on that panel, you know, like come out and they ask questions of each one of them when they come out. But when she comes out and says it, she says that the intelligence people told her it was interdimensional beings.
I like Burchett. I like him. I don't get a bad feeling from seeing him speak.
He seems like he really wants to know what's up.
He seems like a salt of the earth guy. I mean, he's in politics. So, I mean, I think they're all crooked to some extent. You know, he may stand out in front of a large majority of people by not seeming to be as bad as everybody else is. And I think he is honestly looking to try to get the truth out.
Every once in a while, you get a wild card in there who really wants to, really wants to find out the truth, you know.
William, do me a favor. Let everybody know about your festival that you have coming up in June. Let everybody know where they can find your books and anything else you have going on.
Okay. Yeah. Withville UFO Festival. It's June 8th, and it will be held in Withville, Virginia, at the Withville Meeting Center, which is a large, really nice indoor ballroom situation. This will be our third year. We'll probably have something close to 60 or 70 vendors we have a vendor mall area where we've got a section off, and this will be authors and artists, and there will be there'll be people there that are like psychics there that come there. There are all kinds of people that come, you know, that you can meet and talk to, and that's the hanging out area. And then we have some speakers on the other side. And this year we've got a great lineup of speakers. You can go to our website. It's withvilleufofest.com for more information about that. And it's free to the public. You want to come out, you know, we're not charging $1,000, and I can't teach you how to talk to you to aliens or whatever. But I can introduce you to a lot of people that have some really interesting things to say about this subject. And you're certainly welcome to come and share your own stories about it too. We're going to have a panel at the end of the day where we're going to have all the speakers come out together, and then we're going to have because in the past we've had a lot of people, you know, in the audience have questions, and sometimes that runs into the next speaker's time, you know. So I thought, well, this time what we'll just do, we'll just have everybody come out, and we'll have the audience. This will be your whole time where you can field questions to all the speakers. We'll just have that that'll be the end of it. And then my books, Saucers Over Appalachia and The Mad Gasser of Botetourt County, which is a true crime thing that happened in the 1930s around Roanoke, Virginia. Those are both available on Amazon. There are other websites that are available on Amazon. Mystic Novelty is our company where we sell stuff on Etsy. We have an Etsy shop. It's called Mystic Novelty Company, and you can buy them off there too if you're more of an Etsy type of person. But yeah, that's about it.
Well, William, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I appreciate you taking the time and sitting in with me tonight.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. It's a good conversation.
It was a lot of fun. It's good to tear into some stuff now and again. And
Again, I apologize for my crazy shaky camera situation. I was having a problem. I'm doing these very artistic, diagonal shots.
I noticed that.
Because I don't have any. My laptop was giving me problems, you know, connecting. Yeah. And so I had to resort to the phone. And
well, we got it done.
That's where we're at.
We got it done.
It's all right.
It's been a pleasure, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Have a good night.
You too.